namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa buddham dhammam sangham namassami. It's very often the big one of the big questions that comes up is how we fit that meditative experience, that half an hour, that 45 minutes, that hour, that retreat, whatever it is, into the larger sphere of our activities. Why, of course, it's an eightfold path and so on. Speech, action, livelihood, attitude, all part of it. Particularly, quite specifically, what monasteries are about, what this particular tradition, this particular form, lineage form is about, what it can offer. People who wish to see what this can bring. You know, try some of this. It's called a kamatana tradition. Kama, action. Tana, foundation. So it's establish yourself in a certain action. Karma really means the action of intention, direction of the mind. So the mind is always in kamatana, we're establishing ourselves not upon theory, possibilities, but on direct here and now. What's our mind doing? Is it acting? Is it inclining towards skillful, unskillful states in the here and now? Yeah. So karma really means most specifically, most crucially, the action of the mind, including not just thoughts, but even attitudes. Having a malicious attitude or a harsh attitude or a contemptuous attitude will certainly bring results, negative results. Having a joyful attitude, having a gentle attitude, having a resolved attitude will certainly bring results. And these are these attitudes and intentions that we wish to strengthen and cultivate. And this kamatana, monasteries provide possibilities, working models for that. And of course, the point is that, monastery is a good workshop for it, but it is readily translatable into daily life, or it can be translated into daily life for lay people. There's some very fundamental themes being touched on. No. So when we look at a monastery, monastic situation, one of the big elements of it is called sila, virtue, ethics, integrity. So it's principle. And you have many levels of that. You have basically, in a monastery, it's generally the eight precepts. So sila often refers to, most obviously, to particular standards that we can see externally. They're not just our intentions, our attitudes, they're external standards. Refraining from killing, stealing, sexuality, harsh speech, false speech, gossip, chit-chat, alcohol, intoxication, and so forth. The things that we can observe externally. So if that's a form, then we hold that in common. Of course, these external conventions are there to support internal intentions. So if we just have the external conventions, but we're not really taking them to heart, being fully aware of them, and really seeing how we can adjust our mental attitudes and intentions, then this is becomes rather empty, just obedience, just conformity. So you really want to use the precepts and reflect upon them, consider them. So you're looking at things like intentions which are any kind of harming, hurting, abusing, anything, including yourself. Any kind of hankering, taking things that aren't freely happening, any kind of manipulating, pressurizing, demanding. It's not really right, is it? How does that feel? Getting the feeling for these intentions. Because we're not here to policing, but really using precept form to try to draw us back to these intentions that we can sustain because they are actually make us feel good. So just be straight, honest, open, accept what's coming up, what's being offered. So particularly for the alms mendicants, this is the big practice, whatever food, hot, cold, turns up, is offered freely, without being pressurized, without somebody keep dropping hints for special foods, just that which is given freely from a generous, caring place is perfect. Because it's not material food purely, but also the quality of good intention and joyfulness, joyful generosity that we are taking in with our bowls, with our daily food. Really using an alms bowl so it's just the receptacle for generosity. And it's a model, an example of an attitude. What is coming freely. So as we start to look at our covetousness, ambition, manipulation, and then perhaps lowering our preference threshold. Whatever, really. Refraining from sexual restraint, so the particular energies that focus on bodily appearance, on excitement, on passion. Yeah, okay, we can do that. How far does that go? How far does that go? Often, sexuality is often labelled as being, the greatest, happiest, greatest thing that can happen to humans. really? It's pleasure associated with it, otherwise we wouldn't do it at all. But you do realise the sexual experience is, some of it's good, some of it's not so good, some of it's okay. It's limited, and the amount of hassling that goes on, pressurizing, craving, manipulating, seducing, cheating, adultery, and so forth, goes on with it. What's it like to find one's pleasure elsewhere? Through meditation and through a gentle, warm heart. So this certainly is possible. Doing this myself, 36 years, have had some struggles with that, but basically, it's good result. And just begin to see other people as friends rather than just objects. So in these ways, speech particularly, also just how we train ourselves to say what's helpful, realizing with speech we're putting something into other people's minds. It's not just so that I can just empty my thoughts out into the atmosphere, but putting something into other people's minds. Oh, What are we putting in there? Buddha's recommending speech, which is gently spoken at the right time, sensible, worth listening to, worth storing up, bringing friendship and harmony, making little of faults, not continually fault-finding, blaming, nagging, and something that's pleasant to hear. How we can bring this quality to other people. So speech becomes a gift, a treasure. So these precepts remind us, keep bringing us back to intentionality, attitude. What do we want to do with our bodies? What do we do with our mouths? What do we want to do with our energies? There's a way in which it produces something. As the Buddha self guided himself, which is for my welfare, intentions that are for my welfare, because I feel more calm, more self-respect, more dignity, no regrets. What's for other people's welfare, because it doesn't mess them up, it tends to create harmony where there's disharmony, supports, inspires, gladdens, comforts. It's for other people's welfare, and it's conducive to nirvana. So these are the three points: my welfare, your welfare, conducive to peace, nirvana, the ending of defilement. And it reminds us that path is primarily a purification. Not so much about getting something, having some special experience, but clearing away the dust, the fog, with its incumbent suffering, contingent suffering of confusion, raggedy mind, erratic impulses, not knowing really what one's doing, just reacting, getting caught up with things, clearing that away to reveal a sense of purity. So this is the path, purification, clearing, washing, which means we have to start to acknowledge some of the rougher patches, the grubby patches, and start intentionality, karma, relating to that with a steadying mind, with a benevolent mind, with a healing mind, with a firm, clear guidance. So you just start cleaning out the places where the mind rough, unruly, And that's one of the main themes living in monasteries, how to say what's helpful and not say what isn't helpful. Check speech, do what's skillful, not do what isn't skillful. Not be demanding, but be someone who's offering. It doesn't seem so dramatic, but over time what happens is it begins to channel the mental intentions, mental attitudes. And these are so important, because it's exactly this is the source of the suffering that we can cure. It's complaining mind, fault-finding mind, covetous mind, greedy mind, angry mind, impatient mind, jealous mind, doubting mind. These are just this we're clearing. Another big theme in practice, which is very much an extension of the sila and the intentionality principle, is called sangvara, restraining or collecting, gathering, so that instead of every energy running out, we're collecting it, gathering it, gathering in, restraint, sometimes called restraint, sense restraint. In monastery often you find that there's a good amount of time with nothing slated in for it. We have a work period, meditation period, group periods, but then There's times when there's perhaps nothing particularly on the agenda, and then I'm like, what are you going to do, you know? Read something, phone somebody up, figure something out, you know. See how the mind hungers for running out. The monastery is particularly a place where you're supposed to have times when there's nothing much happening. You're not supposed to fill up every moment of the day with activity. It's about learning those precious moments. A lot of the monastery is about waiting. Notice just that 5 minute wait for the meal, waiting after breakfast, rather than, you know, for the work meeting, rather than do something else between this and that, just learning to still, steady, collecting restraint, calm yourself, come back into the body, gathering it in. Not in a tight way, but in a gentle, soothing way. There's nothing much to do right now. See if you can spend 5 minutes just not doing anything. So that does lead towards meditation, a sense of waiting, patience, restraint. And particularly coming from a busy world, this is a very helpful and a training to be picked up. Is perhaps one of the crucial elements of a monastery, which morality certainly, you know, you can work on that in the town, but certainly in life in general, there's always busyness. There's always something to do. In fact, there's generally more to do than you can do. There's work to do, there's tidying up to do, there's contacting people to do, there's remembering things to do, there's making to-do lists, what we should do. There's just passing time, entertainment, having a chat, going to a show, watching movies, reading a book, go out, have dinner, meet somebody. It's not necessarily bad, wrong, immoral, but it's just always, the mind is always being activated. To this and to that, to this and to that. With restraint, we're learning just to turn the engine down, turn the flame down, come out of gear, have those 5 minutes nothing, 10 minutes nothing much, pausing. You know, you get to the end of the cup of tea, pausing, washing up, pausing. Noticing the silences, the empty spaces. This is an important bit of monastic training. And in those pauses and those spaces, if we need something to give the mind something to hold on to, just take a few moments breathing out. Feeling your body, standing, listening to the silence, calming. And over time, it has an effect. We change the rhythm of the mind from that jumping, driving, rushing on. What about this? What about that? Looking for pieces of information, curiosity, this, that, and we change it to, can we enjoy our own stillness, our own nothing much? Quality, deepening quality of receptivity, lessening the quantity of what we put in. Another important element in the training is cooperation. To cooperate, to operate together. It's one of the most powerful trainings, and in some ways the most obvious. When you consider what it is to be a human being, you realize that, you know, we couldn't have got born, we couldn't have got conceived without two beings, without two humans getting together. We couldn't have been born without a whole troop of people helping it happen. Midwives, doctors, nurses, so forth. You couldn't have survived the first few years without constant attention from other human beings. We've got our basic learning of right and wrong from other human beings, how to stand, how to walk. You know, following other people, other humans. We go to school, we learn from other human beings. Every day we live on produce that's been grown by other human beings. Services, letters, post, law and order, telephones that are created by other human beings. Living in the world of other human beings continually, affected by other human beings. Most deeply hurt by other human beings, most wonderfully loved and inspired by other human beings. What's the most difficult thing in the world to do? To get on with other human beings, to cooperate with them. And yet there's so much part of our lives, so much part of what supports us, inspires us, gladdens us, guides us, molds us, and of course irritates us. And we're so much of our mental activity, our emotional states, our psychology, and our bodies is contingent, dependent, affected by the human beings. And yet, one of the most powerful formations that occurs is this sense of self, I am. The self, I am, says, I am independent. I am different. I am distinct, I'm alone, I'm a free individual. I can make my own decisions. There's that one. There's that one, which we all have. And there's the sense of belonging to a larger thing. How are those two going to meet? Is it about squashing, getting rid of the sense of I am? We just become, I am nothing, like an ant, part of the whole thing. Or is it about breaking out from the group, saying, I'm going to do my own thing, I don't need society, other human beings, I'm a non-conformist, whatever. Well, neither of those extremes work in a harmonious way. So it's up for us individually to decide, how can I meet, cooperate with other humans, operate together. Is there a sense of enjoyment meeting, sharing, working together, holding certain values in common, cooperating? Can we get the sense of that? Not conformity, but cooperation. Which means we recognize we're all different. We have our own opinions. We can share our opinions. And yet, essentially, we're looking towards, where does this all meet and merge into a cooperation? Not just my way, my opinion, my view, but cooperate, operate together. This is very much part of what monasteries are about. A lot of it's about holding the sense of the group quite dearly. We all turn up. We all turn up for the work. We turn up for the meditation. We want to offer our services. We want to listen to each other. We want to even receive feedback. Tell me how I'm doing. Buddha said it's impossible to really learn unless you have spiritual friends. People who are going to support you, you can be modelled, model yourself on, you can get advice from. People even will tell you where you're getting it, where they see you getting it wrong. Said without this, I call it death. This is death of the Dhamma fairing. If you can't get that correcting feedback, advice from others. Ajahn Chah said it very simply as following your own teachings is the slow way to learn. You want to listen up to others, not just with your ears, but watching, what are they doing? Okay, how's that? Does she need some help there? So that cooperation. It has this effect of widening your awareness to the larger sphere of what's around us. It continually helps us to sustain that primary guideline of the Buddha when he was practicing, what's for my welfare, what's for the welfare of others, what's conducive to Nibbana. What's for my welfare? And if I bring up thoughts of kindness, steadying my unruliness, pausing before I come out with a speech, it's going to stand me in good stead. I'll be more, I won't have regret. I won't feel disappointed in myself. I'll feel instead a steady, calm mind, good intention. It'll be for other people's welfare, and it's conducive to the clearing away of the defilements. That's what we're here for. So I've been living with this for 36 years, and living in communities, 36 years. It's a constant source of surprise how other people's opinions are different from mine. First, I thought they were just being stupid. Other people's opinions are different from mine on things. But surely. And realizing how strong it is that I want to have it see things my way. And why do we have to do it like that? Surely it's better, like, easier this way. And then you put a group of 10 of us together and there's like 12 opinions. And they're all going different ways. And then you feel, I want to have my opinion, is just get everybody to agree. Because, and particularly with Westerners, we've got a lot of emphasis on ideas and ideals. Most of us can come up with ideas and ideals. We learn a lot, we study a lot, we've got a lot of good ideas and ideals. And a lot of it's true and right. But then the important thing in terms of Dhamma practice is what's right for the whole? What respects other people's opinions? What allows it to settle? What gives us the time to see, well, which of these is really relevant on the ground? And how important is it to me to have things go my way? I must admit, when things go my way, I still get a little bit of a lift of happiness. But I'm careful about that. Because I realize I'm not actually here to have things go my way. I'm here to clear my mind of delusion, selfishness, opinionatedness, intolerance, conceit, arrogance, pride, and so forth. More useful in the long run. So for that, I really get that, keep remembering that. I really don't want to be just, you know, loud-mouthing and pushing and opinionating. I'd sooner just find what's going to, where do we all meet? Where do we all meet? Very important. So in monastic training, there's a lot of recognition of certain areas. You look to people who've been doing it longer, you know, people more experienced, whether they're experienced in Dhamma, experienced in Vinaya, people who are good at buildings, people who are good at plumbing, people who are good at legal matters. You kind of, okay, you know, let them lead. And most important of us, all the expertise and all the technical gifts and skills is for a monastic situation for training. Well, how does this, most important, how does this fit into the Dhamma Vinaya? You know, we want to know that. So we look to people who can guide in that way. You can just say, yeah, it's all true, but this is where it's going to fit most comfortably. You know, we have to wait on this one. That's a great idea, but looks like it's not going to happen now. It doesn't feel quite right now. I have to move that way slowly. Or when an opening occurs, when a situation occurs, you want to push, pressurize. You know, so that kind of measured guidance, the Dhamma. People who look at that. So we look towards, you know, people who can give that guidance, abbots, senior people, more experienced, really know the feel of things, and could gather opinions and let it rest and sit and set, see which seems to be the most appropriate one. It's cooperation. It's clearing the mind of the impetuous, the impulsive, purely idealistic. Sense of needing to have things go one's own way. These things, as you train them, they do touch into particular places where we are blind or impetuous somewhere or another. But the result of it is that your mind becomes steady and sweet, open, receptive. It's not rushing forward. It's not skipping things. It's not fudging. It's not dismissing scruples. It's not, well, it doesn't really matter about that. You know, nobody does that. You know, that voice in your mind. Ah, I just want to relax. Who cares? It doesn't really matter. You know, that one. Or, I'm good. I don't see why I should have to do this. Not for all, I don't know. That one. You know, that kind of, well, what's the point of all this anyway? That voice. So those energies, the strident or the kind of slippery voices that tell you, take it easy, nobody's watching, after all, don't get too uptight about things. That, what's that sound like? Where's that one going? And certainly as one cultivates awareness, you hear a lot of these voices, these moods coming up. And they're not necessarily massive things like, I'm going to kill people. But that's the way that these defilements come. They don't come like massive rocks. They're more like fine dust. You know, if somebody came into this hall and started throwing mud up on the walls, we'd notice it. But what tends to happen is that just the fine dust comes. It doesn't look much different from one day to the next. Same as it was yesterday, roughly. Next day gets a little more dust. If you don't clean it for a week, it doesn't look quite so bright. If you don't clean it for a month, it starts to look pretty messy. And the spiders move in, the cobwebs, gradual pieces start to deteriorate. That's the way it happens with the mind. It isn't that we have massively easy, discernible, big, clunky, muddy defilements. Most of them are just a fine dust of casual, don't really care, manipulations, things like laziness, harsh speech, babbling, that take the brightness away, just slightly dull the brightness of what we're capable of. This is what defilement is. It's not a heavy thing, it's a subtle thing. Some are heavy, but a lot of it is just a subtle dulling. And particularly when one stays in a, for a day we can be quite bright. You try and do it for 3 months, and you find after a few months, probably what happens is you get used to it. Yeah, I kind of know the scene here. I know this certain. I know what I'm doing. I'm fine. I'm okay. And then it starts. You start to find and do it my way. And how to really find, acknowledge, just keep remembering. What are we here for? And as your mind gets comfortable, then you've got to take up the slack with just saying, just be a little brighter, a little clearer, make a little more effort, give a little bit more, quiet a little bit more. So you just keep adjusting. First of all, sometimes it's just difficult to even stay a day in a monastery. That's a strain. When you get comfortable at it, then you've got to start tightening it up a little bit, just taking up the slack. So you say, hey, what am I doing here? Let's keep the kuti clean. Let's make that sharp. Let's keep that dwelling place really clean, tidy. Let's get to things right on time, or even before time. Let's look out for little pieces I can take initiative in doing. So you sharpen and clear. And it's not about being perfect, but it's about constantly bearing in mind the possibilities of a mind that is bright, clear, pure, hasn't got hidden agendas. We only have one face. We don't have a face that only we know and a face we present to the public. We only have one face. So you're always in tune. And that's a theme. When it gets like that, then you wherever you go, when you're like that, dust doesn't land. Dust doesn't settle. Learning to have the cooperative mind also helps our meditation in that, we can come to meditation with how am I going to get my samadhi? So then I want to get it, that sort of pushiness. Or you try to stop your thoughts, or you try to, get things to calm down. And this pushiness, pressure of the mind, always has a harsh, controlling or repressive feel to it. Alternatively, we just sort of, go a bit numb and let things happen. But the real, to me, one of the key words in meditation is receptivity to how the body is, receptivity to how your mind is. Getting home from work, you're busy, you're tired. How do you cooperate with that mind state? What meditation object do you select that will actually sympathize with your mind state? So if your meditation, you chose the meditation topic that's too subtle and your mind is tired, it doesn't pick it up. So you've got to keep cooperating with your current mind state, cooperating with what your body is capable of, and you're finding in that sense of cooperation there's a blending and a harmony, and it's an approach whereby we're always receptive and acting with skillful intentions towards, you know, meditation. The Buddha likened it, to use the simile of the cook, in terms of how you select and maintain a meditation theme. You have the case of the cook who's serving a king, and he cooks up some food, puts it on a plate, and presents it to the king. And then he goes away. He doesn't take note of what the king eats. The king looks at his food. He doesn't really like curries. He doesn't really like meat. So he just eats the potatoes and the beans and whatever. The rest he leaves. Cook doesn't notice that. Doesn't notice what the king picks up. Next day he gives him the same food. King looks at it again, oh, this stuff. Still has the same, doesn't like that, doesn't want that, doesn't, you know. Cook still doesn't notice what the king eats, what the king enjoys. So after a week, the king gives him the sack. And the skillful cook is the one who makes up a plate of food, gives it to the king, watches what the king eats, what he eats eagerly, what he enjoys. Oh, that's good. Next day, I'll give him more of that. Give him more of those peas or the parsnips or whatever it is. King gets more. Oh, that's good. Great. Enjoys it. The cook keeps testing things, checking out what will the king enjoy, what will he take readily. After a week or so, the king promotes the cook. So this is just exactly the same situation as a meditator. You present your meditation theme to the mind, you present it. What's your mind do? Can it pick that up? Yeah, which bits does it pick up? Which bits does it need? Does it need more kindness? Does it need more determination? Does it need more patience? Does it need to sit in your breathing? Does it need to move around your body? What does it pick up? What does it find itself settling in? This is training. You know. You can't force it. Neither can you just let it sit there. You've got to keep applying, putting things in front of it, little bits, tidbits. See what this does. Which part of the breathing does your mind settle into? You know, what's necessary, what's suitable? How do you cooperate rather than dominate or give up? You know? So it could be the case that, you know, people, oh, yeah, meditation, yeah, it's great. You know, I'd like to do that. Well, I can't do that. Yeah, I'd love to be able to do it, but oh, I can't do all that. It's just too much. So what kind of meditation is that? What do we put into that word? Could it be that there's a time that we need to create for ourselves where we consider what's really for my welfare in the here and now? Just being here. What will help to gladden me, calm me, steady me, restrain unskillful impulses? How can I come atan? How can I act? How can I direct my mind in that way? Right now, for let's do this for half an hour. Does it mean walking up and down? Does it mean standing? Does it mean turning certain themes over in my mind, recollecting impermanence, recollecting the good? Does it mean breathing in and out? What's really for my welfare? Because if it's for my welfare in this particular way, in training my intentions and my mind, then it must be for other people's welfare, because it's exactly that mind that's going to move out and touch and affect and regard other people. So if I train my own mind in that way, it cannot be that it will not be for the welfare of others. If I train my mind in this way, it must also be for the elimination of defilement. So it's very important to have that sense of attention, awareness, reflection. How does this thing come together? What is a cooperative way just to be with your own diverse energies, responsibilities, mind states and energies? Monasteries are rather like that on a large scale. How do we fit in with the animals here, with the nature here, with the way it is here, you know, the simplicity? How do we fit in with living in accordance with traditional standards, with the monastic form? How do we cooperate with that? How do we cooperate as men and women, old and young? How do we come together? To really get a feeling for that is a fine training, and particularly monasteries, because people are coming and going. So every few weeks, every week, so it's a new set. And you're always learning. You know, it's not just being friends with this particular person, but learning to listen in, tune in, and adopt certain standards that we can all cooperate around. So, offer these thoughts for your consideration. Personally, I found it my first time at Wat Buddha Dhamma, you know, being very welcomed, relaxed, friendly, really nice. So I hope I can, life and conditions will support me coming again, but you never know, do you? So I'll leave you these few words as for my little offering to the community at this time.
Annamayam dhamma kathaya sadhu karam dhamase
sadhu 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 annamayam.
I just want to say heartfelt thanks Thanachan for visiting us and offering much advice and dhamma reflections, and very positive experience, inspiring, just to be with a very senior monks and to learn from your experience and your wisdom. Thank you.
Sangha.